As I mentioned last week, my family and I took a long road trip to Western Canada last month. We spent quite a bit of time in Saskatchewan, where I grew up. The picture on the bulletin cover is of my dad's potato farm, which is just south of Saskatoon. We got as far west as Lake Louise in the Rockies before turning around and heading home. Now, I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but Canada is a really, really big country. This road trip was so long, we needed to get an oil change halfway through. This road trip was so long, we counted it not by kilometers, but by time zones. This road trip was so long, we listened to the entire Lord of the Rings trilogy on audiobook, plus all the appendices. It was a lot of time in the car together, and for the most part, our boys did pretty well, but there were some times when they got on each other's nerves and on my nerves as well. And I could always tell when trouble was coming. I could tell when I got really quiet in the back seat. And then the whispers would start, and then the pokes, and then the shoves, and then some argument would break out about a book or a snack or breathing one another's air. And then I would put on my dad voice. "What are you guys doing back there?" And the answer would always be, "Nothing." I never had to pull out the classic, "Don't make me turn this car around" move, but I did think about it. Our road trip was on my mind this week because, as we heard in our Mark reading, Jesus and the disciples are on a road trip of their own, on foot, through Galilee back to their home base in Capernaum. And we hear Jesus had his own "What are you guys doing back there?" moment. As Mark tells it, on this road trip, Jesus reiterates what it means to proclaim him as the Messiah. Despite the conventional understanding at that time that the Messiah was to be a great military leader in the mold of David, Jesus says that his will not be a call to arms. His will not be a rallying of the Rohirrim. His will not be a victory march into Caesarea Philippi or Jerusalem or Rome. The Son of Man, he tells his disciples, is to be betrayed. Betrayed into human hands, and they will kill him. And after 3 days, he will rise again. But as Mark continues, they did not understand what he was saying and were afraid to ask him. There are times when we are silent because we do not want to hear what we fear we might hear. It is easier to keep quiet, to pretend we do not understand, than to ask questions and run the risk of hearing something we might not like. And so, in silence, the disciples continue down the road following Jesus. And as they walk, it stays quiet for a while, but then the whispers start, and then the pokes, and then the arguments. And when they get to Capernaum, Jesus asks them, "What were you arguing about on the way?" And for a second time, Mark says that they were silent. But I'd like to think at least one of them mumbled, "Nothing." This second silence, though, I believe, was not out of confusion or evasion, but out of shame. Because what they were arguing about on the road was who among them was the greatest. Perhaps they really did understand what Jesus was saying about his death, and they were already jockeying for who would replace him in the movement, who would be the triumphant one riding into Caesarea Philippi or Jerusalem or Rome, who would be the liberator setting the people free from domination, who would be, like David, the great man of story and song. We often judge the disciples harshly, and tut, tut, their inability to get it. But we should not lose track of context and just how radical and countercultural what Jesus was saying, how it would have been then and how it still is now. Competition for power and wealth and prestige was just as prevalent in Jesus' time that it is now. And by every measurable standard of that day, the disciples were from the lower end of the socioeconomic spectrum. Rural fishers, farmers, laborers, but by their association with Jesus, they've been elevated into the inner circle, the privileged entourage of God's own anointed one. On this long trip, they have been drawing great crowds, bearing witness to miracles, teaching, forgiving. They've even been given the power to heal and to cast out demons. Imagine how that would have felt. The energy, the excitement, the power of proximity to Jesus. Small town boys make it big, splashed across the headlines of local papers. But just when they are at the top of their game, Jesus, what he does what he does so often, he flips the tables. Following him, he tells them, will not bring power and glory, but vulnerability and suffering. Not honor, but dishonor. Not status, but rejection. Not greatness, but lowliness. Whoever wants to be first must be last of all and servant of all. And then to bring his point home, to make sure there is absolutely no confusion or ambiguity about what he is talking about, Jesus takes up a child in his arms, walks her over among the disciples, and says to them, "Whoever welcomes one such child in my name welcomes me. And whoever welcomes me welcomes not me, but the one who sent me." Wow. It is difficult to overstate just how challenging this would have been. Again, socio-historical context is important here. In first century Israel, while certainly loved, children were regarded as non-persons, or at least not yet persons in society. They were essentially possessions of their father. Children had no status, no political status. They did not contribute to the economic value of the household or community. In the Roman world, which preferenced power and wealth and prestige, there would have been no benefit from the elevation or inclusion of a child in the way that Jesus did on that day. But even more than inclusion, Jesus equates the welcoming of such a child to the welcoming of him, and through him, the welcoming of God who sent him. Then and now, this is a shocking depiction of God, of Jesus' messiahship and the kingdom of God he came to proclaim. Through the inclusion of a child, Jesus stands in direct conflict with the dominant values of not just his own culture, but of most cultures that have ever existed on this planet. Dr. Joyce Mercer from the Yale Divinity School says that in this text, Jesus is calling the disciples and all those who would follow him then and now to do two things: to welcome the child and to emulate the child. Welcome the child and emulate the child. Let's start with welcome. To welcome the child means listening to the child, honoring their voice and perspective, including them in decisions that affect them, making sure they have a safe and healthy environment that they may live and thrive. So how, I wonder, are we doing with this here in this rich, powerful country of ours? According to research put out by the charity Children First Canada, 1/3 of Canadian children do not enjoy a safe and healthy childhood. 1 in 3 Canadians report experiencing abuse before the age of 15. 1 in 5 children live in poverty. Suicide is the leading cause of death in children ages 10 to 14 in this country. All children and youth have been affected by the pandemic these past 18 months, but First Nations, Métis, Inuit, Black, and other children of color have been hit particularly hard. Now, in this election season, various media outlets have been asking children and youth what they are most concerned about. They name issues such as equity, discrimination, housing, access to education, Indigenous issues, and climate change. Climate change. Again and again, children, including my own, name climate change as something they are very concerned about. And for good reason. According to the United Nations, almost half the world's 2.2 billion children are already at extremely high risk from the impacts of the climate crisis and pollution. This has immense physical and psychological impacts on the youth of this planet. UNICEF recently published a report that says 6 in 10 young people around the world aged 16 to 25 were extremely worried about climate change. 4 in 10 are hesitant to have children. They're not sure if they want to have kids of their own because of the climate crisis. 3/4 agreed with the statement, "The future is frightening." A similar number said, governments were not protecting them, the planet, or future generations, and that they felt betrayed by older generations and governments. Jesus equated welcoming the child to welcoming him. And just as he heard the disciples arguing behind him and turned to confront them, the children of the world, who are often the leading voices when it comes to environmental issues, are now turning around to confront older generations and governments. What are you arguing about back there? Can't you see that our future is at stake, that our very lives are on the line? And you're arguing. Arguing about what? Money and status and power? What are you doing back there? And for far too often and for far too long, the answer has been nothing. Climate change has significant implications for the health and future of children. But in our current global systems of governance, they have very little power to limit its harm, making them feel vulnerable, powerless, without agency, and therefore susceptible to anxiety and depression. So how do we take Jesus' call to welcome the child more seriously? Henrietta Fore, the executive director of UNICEF, says, "Children and young people need to be recognized as the rightful heirs of this planet that we all share. They need to be included in the decisions that will define their future, not just in tokenistic head patting, but real participation. This kind of inclusion should happen at the global scale, such as at the UN Climate Change Summit happening in Glasgow in November, but also needs to happen at the local level, within governments and institutions and any organization that bears responsibility for safeguarding this planet for future generations, including the church. Whoever welcomes one such child in my name welcomes me. And whoever welcomes me welcomes not me, but the one who sent me." We recognize that welcoming the child is an area where much work is needed. Metropolitan has engaged with the GO Project, which is an organization within the United Church that develops programs and curriculum for youth and believes that, quote, "Young people have the gifts, knowledge, and insights to drive the transformation of their communities and the world." Reverend Alana Martin, who is the minister of the GO Project, is also our children and youth minister, our youth animator here at Met. Right now, she is leading a Sunday school class on Zoom for the children of the congregation, including my own. In the coming weeks, we want to build a team around Alana to help foster the spiritual growth of children, to more fully include them into the life of this church, and to help reach out to new youth and families looking for spiritual community. If you are interested in serving in this way, please be in touch. Jesus calls all those who would be his followers to welcome the child, but also to emulate the child. Reverend Jean Stairs, who has done extensive work in pastoral care of children, writes in her book, Listening for the Soul, that children possess an innate spiritual hunger and openness. Children seem to know things, including spiritual things that no one has told them. They are spiritually alert and listen naturally for the voice of God. Doesn't that sound like something we should all be aspiring to? this attentiveness and openness, this deep knowledge of the source of things often comes naturally to children. It doesn't have to be forced through doctrine or dogma. It comes in play and daydreams and exploration of God's good and growing world. Have you ever noticed that truly spiritual people, even the ones in advanced age, often come across as childlike, filled with awe and wonder? Think of the Dalai Lama laughing, high-pitched, joyful, and often. Picture St. Francis skipping through the forests around Assisi barefoot and jabbering on to the birds. When Jesus took up the child in his arms and told his followers that whoever welcomes a child welcomes him, he was also talking about the child within us that is so often pushed down by the cultural pressure that prioritizes power and wealth and status. He is calling those who would be his followers to reclaim what has been lost and to live by a different set of values and priorities that come so naturally to children. As you likely know, the federal election is tomorrow. But have any of the parties been talking about empowering people to find more awe in their lives, more wonder in their lives? Are any of them creating a national strategy for play? Are any of the pollsters tracking joy or gratitude or compassion or spiritual attentiveness? Whoever welcomes a child welcomes me. It really is radical and countercultural and table flipping, this thing that Jesus is proposing. And so I have an invitation for you this week, something that may be challenging, but will help us embody Jesus' call to welcome the child within. Your invitation this week is to do something the world would label as childish, silly even, something that contributes nothing to the GDP or has any value within our consumerist culture. Give it a try. Skip stones in a pond. Squish mud between your toes. Doodle in the margins. Laugh. Dance in the kitchen. Talk to the birds. Look up at the night sky and count the stars. Believe. Believe that the child within you, the one that has no status or power in this world, the one that maybe hasn't been allowed out to play in decades, believe that the child within you is vital, vital to Christ's radical, countercultural, table-flipping mission in the world. Whoever welcomes one such child in my name welcomes me. And whoever welcomes me welcomes not me, but the one who sent me. May it be so.